versus Friday evening was I don't have to make any exceptions. We've already had the privilege and the benefit of a wonderful presentation this evening. We want our children to be happy or good. I must tell you that Dr. Trussell spoke to boys and girls today also. Very lively discussions, I understand. Very much so. Apathy was not one of the products of these discussions, which was very good. This evening, the topic that will be discussed was prevention, the impact of home environment, home bias, etc., on raising emotionally healthy and secure children. It's a universal topic, obviously very, very important, and I would like to introduce now Dr. Sorokin, who will address us on this most important subject.
Good luck. Thank you very much. First of all, I'd like to thank everyone for a very inspiring and meaningful Shabbos. It was really nice when we come to a place and everybody's really interested in the topic and very dedicated to trying to learn more about it. And it was really, I found it very exciting. So tonight that we're talking about prevention and the impact of the home environment on raising emotionally healthy and secure children. So we might want to ask, like, why are we specifically targeting the home environment? After all, there are other environmental impacts on children, such as school and friends and otherwise. And I think, well, the most important reason is because that's where we have the most input. And even schools who are responsive to parental concerns, there's a limit how much a school is going to respond to a particular parent. But at home, that's really the place that parents have the most input. So we as parents, that's the place where we can do the most to provide a child with a healthy environment. And secondly, the second reason is because I think it's indisputable, at least in my eyes, that parents have the largest impact, more than anybody else, on a child's emotional health. Sometimes when children get older, it seems to us we don't have that much impact, maybe other friends in school and others may have more impact, but certainly in the development, in the formative years, when the child's psychic structure is being formed, certainly parents have more of an impact than anyone else. The child's sense of self, see, many of the problems we see in older children, in teenagers, and even young adults, are related to problems that developed when children were younger, when they were children. If a person grows up feeling that they can't be successful, right? So later on in life, even if they'll be tremendously successful, it's not going to impact on their, favorably on their self-esteem. For example, what do I mean? Sometimes you have a child, let's say, who has very poor self-esteem. So I'll be talking to a teacher or parents, and they'll say, you know what this kid needs? He needs opportunities for success. Anybody ever heard that expression? You know, that's the solution. If you give him opportunities, find something he's good at, and you give him opportunities for success, and then his self-esteem will improve. Unfortunately, it doesn't work most of the time. Because very often, if he didn't grow up with self-esteem, he does not know how to translate success into self-esteem. It doesn't happen automatically. I'm sure every person in this room knows at least one adult who is extremely successful and has absolutely no self-esteem. Right? It's a bit amazing. How could it be? How could a person have no self-esteem when they're so successful? But they don't know how to they don't interpret their success as success. An expression I have for that is that some people are experts in snatching defeat from the jaws of victory. Right? And I sometimes will speak to a kid and they'll say, oh, I had a rotten week this week. What happened? And they'll describe an incident that's really a success. Something that's especially for them, some problem that they're dealing with, some difficulty that they have. Let's say they have problems with the social anxiety. And they find it difficult to interact with other people, other kids, or whatever. Then they describe a situation where they actually put themselves out there and they interacted with somebody, but there was a little bit of anxiety, maybe even much less than they normally suffer from. So to me, it's like I'm like all excited that, you know, even tried to do it and actually went pretty decently, but to them, that 2 seconds of anxiety ruined the whole thing. To them, that's a tremendous failure. So that's why, how does that happen? because they already have it in their heads that they're failures. So therefore, those formative years are very, very important, and that's why whatever we can do to make the home environment a healthier place, that has a tremendous long-term impact. So when we look, when we think about those years, when we think of a child, let's say if a child lives in an unhealthy environment, whether it's abusive or less than that, so we think about it, so Achmanis on the kid, you know, he doesn't really deserve to be treated that way, he doesn't deserve this misery. We think about it only in the limited terms of what's going on to him in that period of time. But if we understood the damage to the psychic structure, it's like building a house with a cracked foundation, right, and it has long-term impact. And that's something that really the parents have more of an impact than anyone else. Because probably one of the things that troubles children more than anything else, I think this is a pretty safe statement to make, that if you want to look at all the problems that kids suffer from, probably the underlying issue, and almost all therapists will tell you that it's because of poor self-esteem. But if you want to know what underlies poor self-esteem, it's feeling that they have disappointed their parents on a chronic basis. Right? And that's something that a child will feel only a disappointing parents will have that impact. A teacher being disappointed in a child usually doesn't upset a child half as much. So that's why we're focusing on the home environment. Now when we talk about an unhealthy home environment, there are sometimes situations where the unhealthy nature of the environment is obvious, where there's a total lack of shalom bias, where there's, you know, behavior that's overtly abusive, you know, screaming and yelling and chronic hitting, where there's abuse that probably even other people know about. It's something that's very obvious. When that happens, when it reaches that degree, one of the impact that has on the child is that the child's whole focus of life is to stay out of trouble. It's not to be creative. It's not to grow spiritually, emotionally, to become productive. That is definitely not what the child's focused on. What the child's focused on is staying out of trouble, flying under the radar. That becomes a whole obsession. As one youngster once told me, that his father unfortunately had a pretty strong temper. Most times he was actually very nice and pleasant, but sometimes he would have a temper and come in and be very agitated. So this kid told me that he learned to identify from his father's footsteps coming up to their apartment. He was able to tell exactly, you know, his father's mood. He would know precisely how his father's mood was just from hearing his footsteps, right? So that's actually very, very sad. I guess he shows you a pretty smart kid, but it's really very sad that that's what his life, his emotional energy wasn't focused on growing and understanding the world and learning about things. That was his emotional energy was focused on staying out of trouble. Now, of course, what happens, this is when they're younger. Of course, when they get older, then many of these problems that are not so obvious when a child is young because they're very dependent and they're much easier to control, when they get older, we see the reaction to this. Now, even though this should be obvious, what I'm describing right now should be obvious, it's quite amazing to me that there's a tremendous amount of denial of this, even in school settings and yeshivas, that people sort of even question whether this type of home environment, who says it's so damaging? I remember not too long ago, I spoke to a parent. No, I was speaking to a Rebbe. There was a young boy who, unfortunately, his father is an alcoholic, who was at that point in deep denial, even though it was going on for years, and there were times that he would just really totally lose it at home. He'd become physically abusive at home. And this boy, not surprisingly, was not behaving properly most of the time, and they were threatening to throw him out of the yeshiva. So with the boy's permission and the mother's permission, I spoke to the Rebbe, and I was trying to get them to be a little bit more understanding and sympathetic. So I explained to him what's going on within this boy's life, and since then I was trying to tell him to cut the boy a little slack, you know, he's really going through a very difficult time, and maybe he could be a little bit understanding. So I described the situation, and this Rebbe tells me, he says to me, oh, well, that's really very sad, you know, but do you think his behavior really has anything to do with that? I'm like, how do you know? Okay, someone's dropped the phone. I couldn't believe you'd ask me such a question. It would seem to me like obvious. But somehow, it's just not so clear to us that this type of environment could have such a destructive effect. Now, very often the situation is nowhere near that. There's nothing like overtly abusive or any horrible things going on. It could be a reasonably stable and very often even what would be considered in the best of homes, very often that expression is used. And very often, you know, every home, you know, every restaurant has an ambiance. You know, you talk about different restaurants, you know what they're like. And every has an atmosphere, a certain ambiance about it. Every home has the same thing. Every home has a certain atmosphere. And it's very often related to the parents' very often unconscious beliefs, the way they see the world, the way they see themselves, the way they see their children, what they expect from their children. So this could be a very subtle thing. There's a certain atmosphere in the house that has a very strong effect on the children. Now here too, since we're not aware of this, this often happens very subconsciously and pre-reflectively, we don't reflect upon it. What happens is, very often, we don't see ourselves as creating this environment. We see ourselves as reacting to the environment. A very sad example of that, a few years ago I was met this young man, this father asked me to meet his teenager who was having some difficulties. And I asked the father before I met, I wanted to meet with the parents, the mother couldn't make it. Eventually she turns out she never really came in, she would never come. But I met the father and he was describing me the symptoms his son was suffering from. And I asked him, what about the home environment, what's happening there? He told me everything is fine. Okay. After I met the child for a while, this youngster, it became apparent that his mother was incredibly critical. She was something really off the charts. Very, very chronic. Anything anybody did, including a husband, was no good. So I meet the father again, and I told him what I understood from his son. So he says, yes, it is. It's very terrible. You know, he suffers from it, but that he's willing to live with. But the fact, it's impacting all the children. And there's a lot of problems with them. But he told me what's most ironic is that she has absolutely no clue. She sees herself as just reacting to her child's misbehavior. And he told me it was so bad, this lady, she sees herself as a tzaddikus. She says, Tehillim most of the day is doing chesed. That's what she does. So she told her husband, who's a very chashuv person, become a chacham. She told her husband once that the problems that she's having with her children is a tremendous insane to her, because she can't understand why, if she does all these good things, why Hashem sends her one problem child after another. But it's really very sad, because she's really a nice lady, but she really has no idea that she is creating something. She sees herself, she's the victim. She sees herself as merely reacting to something that's totally out of her control. Of course, that makes it almost impossible for anything to get better, because she totally doesn't understand the problem. Now, this is a very good example of one of the most difficult issues in parenting is that it really doesn't have much to do with techniques, and has a lot more to do with attitudes. Research has shown that many parenting classes are not very, very effective because they focus on techniques. How do you deal with this particular issue? How do you deal with that particular issue? It doesn't deal with the attitudes that underlie the behaviors. For example, there's a phenomenal study by a fellow named Strasberg. And I'll just give you an example of one of the studies that will illustrate this point, because I think it's very, very crucial and important in trying to change these things. What he did was, he made a video clip of parents, of a child acting in a pretty typical way. You'd have a short video clip of Johnny sitting on the floor playing with toys, and then his mother tells him, okay, Johnny, it's time to put away your toys, it's time to go to sleep. And Johnny very typically reacts with, oh, come on, mommy, it's all, oh, come on, I want to move the game, I don't want to stop. Right? And that's it. That's the whole video clip. You don't see any response, nothing. Then what Strasberg did, he asked the mothers to write a one-paragraph description of what they just observed. Right? And what he found was that he took two groups of mothers. There was one group who had a lot of problems with their children, and another group that didn't. And he found that they described the same event in a totally different way. The parents who didn't have any difficulties described this as a normal thing. As a kid, he doesn't want to, he wants to finish the game. He's upset because he's in the middle of the game. He doesn't want to, he doesn't want to stop. And the other parents describe this as like something terrible going on. This is a child who's rebellious, who's trying to undermine his mother's authority, who's, not only acting totally inappropriately in their eyes, they even attributed malicious intent. I've heard parents describe six-month-old children as being manipulative. Right? And they really mean it. These are not bad people. I don't think they understand, what these things are. And of course, what ends up happening is when you see it that way, the way you react is perfectly reasonable. So you can't teach parenting techniques because according to what you observe, you know, if your child's trying to rebel and overthrow your authority, then, you know, it would be reasonable to have some sort of strong reaction. But if you understand it as a normal behavior, then your reaction will, of course, be different. So let's focus on some parental misconceptions or misperceptions that underlie some of the difficulties that we sometimes experience. So, very often, one of the things that we actually touched upon, and I think yesterday, but I think it's worth focusing on again, because I think it underlies many of the problems that we have to deal with. We often believe that if a child does the right thing, no matter how we get him to do it, then that is good. Because doing good things is good, by definition. If he's doing something good, it's good. Right? Very often, there's no sense of self that's involved in any of these activities. It's become, I don't know about what's going on here, but in New York, the latest rage in the last few years that every bar mitzvah bacher has to make a siyum ha-mishnayos. Otherwise, you can't have a bar mitzvah. It's not enough that you have to know how to lane, and you have to give a drasha, and do all these other things just to make life a little more difficult. They also have to make a siyum mishnayos. And if not, then you're not Jewish. It's a shayla. You know, you have to ask a shayla if it's a shayla. You know, I don't know who came, and once one kid did it, maybe it actually made sense for the first kid who did it, but once he did it, you gotta keep up with the Joneses, everybody has to do it. So, used to be that a child, a bar mitzvah bacher's life only became miserable, let's say, a few months before, because he had to, you know, he had to prepare and have to stand on that, because of course, God forbid that he should make a mistake while he lane. So the guy who's getting paid $100 a shot to lane, he's allowed to make mistakes, but the poor 13-year-old boy, he's forbidden to make mistakes. However, now you have to start already a year and a half before, you have to start harassing him so to make sure that he'll finish the Mishnayos by the time of his bar mitzvah. So, you know, what ends up happening, there's no ownership. It's not something that the child decided he wants to do. It's something he's doing to please his parents. So there's no sense of self. You know, a teenager asked me last week, he said, why do I have such a problem with self-discipline? Because he was trying to go to college. He really wanted to go. Actually, it was about 20, he was trying to go to college, but he was like sleeping through, he was missing classes in the morning. So he tells me, why don't I have self-discipline? I told him it's very simply because you don't have a self. He thought his problem was with the discipline part of it. I said, no, your problem is not with discipline, you don't have a self. You can't have self-discipline without a self. Your whole discipline, your whole life had nothing to do with you. And now you're trying to have self, now that you're not under the control of your parents anymore, and you're trying to have self-discipline, you don't have to have self-discipline without a self. And I think when children are young, we don't focus on this. The children, and when I spoke to the youngsters today, especially the boys, you know, one thing I noticed is, you know, they think that the problem is that it's hard for them to do mitzvahs, at least some of them, because, you know, they don't have the proper hashkafa. You know, if they only understood why to do the mitzvahs, then everything would be fine. This is very common for kids to think this way, and very often adults understand it that way too. In fact, in New York, there's a whole organization that's geared to teaching youngsters hashkafa, because they felt, because usually when a kid has a hard time doing the religious obligation he's supposed to do, they describe it, you know, why should I do it, and who said I should do it, and what are the philosophical implications of what I do. So there are well-meaning people that feel that, you know, if kids would understand hashkafa better, they'd be more comfortable doing these things. I think these are wonderful people, but I think they're on the wrong track. I personally believe that it's good probably for everybody, even if everything is fine in their lives, but this is not going to solve the problem. Because, like we spoke yesterday, the children react to what we want them to do according to how successful we are in giving over the Messiah. There are many kids who feel perfectly comfortable living the parents' way of life without understanding the first thing about it. Not every child is a miniature philosopher. And now, if your child happens to have an interest... You know, sometimes I get a call from a Rebbe, he says, listen, maybe you can see this kid, he's 14 years old, he has a big problem, maybe you can see him. I say, what's his problem? He says he has hashkafa problems. I said, oh, you mean this 14-year-old kid is obsessed with questions that the Rambam didn't start thinking about till he was 40? You know, that's ridiculous. Usually there's something wrong in his connection to his home. And therefore, now he has a million questions. If you went to a doctor, I have a patient who's very suspicious of everybody. It's, you know, based on his whatever, he has lifelong problems with trusting people. So what ends up, when he goes to a doctor, and the doctor gives him a medication, he calls up I think the National Institute of Health has a hotline or something that's made for doctors. He calls up, he makes it, this is Dr. Goldberg, and he starts questioning all about his medication, any medication he gets, right? Because he can't trust anybody. So it's not a lack of knowledge on his part, it's a lack of trust. So if our children had a more comfortable connection with us, I think it would be more likely that these problems wouldn't bother them so much. Actually, there's something I saw, such an incredible, insightful thing that I heard from Rabbi Tzitzel Salman about self-discipline. He was saying, I guess, it's based on a Zayar. You know, when we think about self-discipline, when we talk about the Ur HaMitzvah, the yoke of mitzvahs, right? It's typically, certainly in many children's eyes, it's the image you get is very negative. For I would dare say by many adults it's the same. You know, you think it's sort of the image I think of is the ones in New York. I don't know how it is here, but when the kids are walking to school with their backpacks, you ever see like these kids in first grade, like you bent over double, you know, their backs totally misaligned, the chiropractor's dream, you know, walking with their backpacks. And that's how we think the Ur HaMitzvahs. You know, you walk around with this yoke, an incredible burden. So he brought that from the Zayar, an incredible, insightful idea that what is really a yoke? You know, what if you think about it, I guess we don't have too many farmers around here probably, so we don't think about this, but if you were, what do you have a yoke? You have two oxen, they're supposed to plow the field, so what you could do is you can take a rope, tie it to the plow, and wrap it around their bodies or their necks, and schmeiß them until they go with it. Of course, it would be extremely painful. The idea of a yoke is to evenly distribute the weight over the body to make it easy, like backpackers who have these expensive backpacks, they can schlep quite a bit without too much of a strain. Because these rigid frames, they evenly distribute the weight. So what is a yoke? A yoke is a tool to get your job done comfortably. If children saw it that way growing up, that there are goals that they're interested in, either because they understand them or only because they want to be like us and they see it's important to us and we have a comfortable relationship with them, so they want to be the same way. And therefore, it's easier to give them the message that in order to accomplish what you want to accomplish, having these tools of self-discipline and other tools will help you accomplish the goals that you want to accomplish. But the way they see it, unfortunately, is that this is supposed to help them accomplish the goals that we want them to accomplish. And there's no ownership, there's no self that's involved in these ideas. So that's, I think, probably the most important idea that we can come away from here tonight, and just reiterating what I said yesterday, is that just getting somebody to do something, no matter how wonderful behavior it is, without them really feeling on their own that has something to do with them, I think is not only useless, it's counterproductive. Because they will either they'll grow up to be very obedient, but with no sense of self, so just do whatever anybody tells them, or eventually they'll rebel because it won't feel like it has anything to do with them. Usually you can see this when people get older and you talk to them about what they want to do. People who have problems with shidduchim, they can never decide who to marry, or what kind of job to do, or what school to go to. And you ask them, well, what would you like to do? They don't know how to relate to the question because they can't relate to the word you. I'm serious. They don't know how to they'll want to know what I think and what would I suggest to them, and they'll go to 1,000 people, you know, each person to give them a different aid, so they can't relate to the question, what do you want to do? The whole concept doesn't exist in their brain. They do what other people tell them to do. And when I try to explain, even when I discuss something with them and tell them what I think about it, right away they accept it. I said, well, how can you accept it? You didn't even think about it. How do you know what I said makes sense? Maybe I told you something that's totally ridiculous. And even if it makes sense, it might not make sense to you. I encourage them to disagree with me. You know, I don't want them to do because I thought it was good. You know, tell me if it makes sense to you. Now, another belief that many parents have that could be very, very harmful is that many parents believe that the purpose of the child's existence in life is to bring them nachas, right? And you go to any, did I speak about this yesterday? No, okay. If you go to any bar mitzvah, right, what is the bracha that every speaker gives to the child? Mitzvah Hashem, you should bring nachas to your parents. I have been complaining about this probably for the last 15 years. To who? To my friends, obviously. I'm not going to complain to the bar mitzvah bracha, to his parents. So I said, my friends, always make, it came to the point they always laugh at me. You know, it's like a running joke. Whenever somebody says, they all look at me and smirk. So, fortunately, somebody had the chesed to fax me from one of Rabbi Fran's books. He has a story there from the Brisker Rav, and I'm off the hook. What did the Brisker Rav say? He has an interesting story there. There was this fella, I guess it was one of the Brisker Rav's Talmidim, that he was a young father with many children, and he was an extremely dedicated father. He was spent a lot of time with them, and he was always good-natured, and he was always calm, and he was always involved. He was like an exemplary father. And one day, this young man's uncle came to visit, and he was like so impressed. He was like, what an incredible father he was. So he asked the father, tell me, how are your children ever going to repay you for what you're doing for them? So the father thought about it for a minute, and he says, well, you know, children give you a sense of immortality, that you feel that you live forever through your children. That's how they repay you. Later on, I guess he told over to the Brisker Rav, his father, what his uncle asked him and what he answered. And the Brisker Rav told him, you know, your answer is karev l'apikorsis. It's almost apikorsis what you said. Why? What's such a terrible answer? He said, because the Baruch Hashem does not give parents children to get anything from them. The Baruch Hashem gives parents children in order that they can emulate Hashem and give without any cheshbon of getting back, without any calculations of getting anything back. Now, the Brisker Rav said, that was mechavan to that too, Baruch Hashem, that the Brisker Rav said, you can give a parent a bracha that they should have nachas from their children. Just like you can give a bracha, they should have health and parnasa. That has nothing to do with the child. In fact, I'll tell you something very fascinating, a halachic concept that I think I heard in a tape once, Beshem the Stifler, but I can't remember. I heard it quite a while ago, so I'm not positive. But it's an unbelievable thought. You know, let's say if a person made a neder, he made a vow, that the next person who asks him for money, he'll give him. Okay? So that Reuven made such a vow. Shimon comes along, and he is the first person to ask Reuven. Let's say you know about it. So he right away runs over to Reuven and says, hey, give me $50. And Reuven doesn't want to give it to him. Could Shimon go to Beis Din and demand and sue Reuven for the money? What do you think? Any thoughts about that? Then Reuven made a vow that he's going to give the next person to ask him for money, he's going to give it to him. And Shimon comes and asks him for money, and Reuven doesn't give it to him. Does Reuven have a standing to come and sue Shimon? Halachas, he doesn't. Because he doesn't have standing in this, because he's an incidental byproduct, right? Beis Din can force Shimon to keep his vow like they can force him to keep do any other mitzvah, but it has nothing to do with Reuven. He just happens to be the person. So the Stifler said that's the same position that parents have regarding, let's say, kibud aveim. You know, most parents think that kibud aveim is like sort of like you buy a house, so you have rights on the house. It's your property. And many parents think that's what kibud aveim gives them, those rights. The Stifler explained it's not like that. The child has a chiv of kibud aveim, has nothing to do with the parent. It just happens to be that they're the target of it. But the rights of the parents regarding that mitzvah are no different than the rights of the parents regarding the child wearing tefillin. You know, that's not something he owes you. He has to wear tefillin. You have a job as a parent to mechanech him in such a way that he'll want to put on tefillin. And you have to buy him a pair. You have to make it possible for him to do. So you have to create such an atmosphere that he should be able to do this. That he should be able to keep it out of him. It's not a right that you have to demand from him. All right? So it's the same thing with nachas, that it's not a right that we have. It's an incidental byproduct of doing things right. Of course, if we have enough sense to have nachas, letting the child live his own life and not expecting to do exactly what we want. So then, if everything works out okay, so then mitzvah Hashem will have nachas. But it's not an obligation of the child. And this can make a tremendous difference, because this leads, when parents believe that that's their right, that they could demand this and that's their child's obligation, this almost guarantees that a child will feel that his parents are disappointed in them. You know, a while back ago, a few years ago, I was seeing this young man. He came to me at the age of 19, if I'm not mistaken, and he had already been severely depressed for 5 years before I met him. He had been on every antidepressant that had been invented and discovered, and none of them touched him. So after I got to know him for a while, one day he tells me, he says, it came out that his parents are very high-driven, perfectionistic people, and he was probably the smartest of the siblings, and he was actually told that, you know, this is what their expectations are, you're going to take over your father's position or whatever. This was, his whole life was mapped out for him, what he's supposed to do to make his parents happy. So one day I met this young man together with his mother, He turns to his mother and says, you know, I now realize that there's nothing I ever did in my life for any other purpose other than to make you happy and to please you. I never did anything for myself or for its own value. And I'm telling you, I'm not exaggerating a drop. The mother turned to me with this puzzled look on her face, and she says, like, so what's wrong with that? I'm telling you, and I'm not saying this to make fun of her, because she was really innocent. She said, you know, she's a wonderful lady who would do anything for a kid, and did not understand that this was a problem. In fact, she told me, till this day, she still only does things to please her mother. Right? And she really doesn't know why that's a problem. She doesn't understand what it means when a person doesn't do anything for themselves, when they don't understand the value of something for themselves. Now, you know, very often, you know, when parents have difficulties with children, a parent will say something to me like, let's say if there's conflict in the house or conflict between the parent and the child, and the parent will say to me, but he knows I love him. He knows I love him. I say, yeah, probably. It's very rare that you find a parent who doesn't love their children. In fact, the Rambam, the Mar Nevuchim, says it's an instinct that's inborn in any parent, even animals. Even animals, all mammals, you know, love their offspring. It's like a natural instinct. You don't get a medal for that. That just seems to be part of what we are. What the children need more than our love, what our children need more than our love, is our acceptance and respect. And here too, one day I found in one of the Israeli religious magazines, they quoted, he bring that from the Chazon Ish, that the Chazon Ish said that our children need our respect much more than our love. And I think that often children feel they're lacking. I don't think too many children feel that their parents don't love them. Almost any parent would give their life for their child. Sometimes after years of conflict, sometimes, you know, that unfortunately comes to a point where that sort of doesn't seem to be there anymore. But certainly in the earlier years, no matter how bad things are, it's very rare. I've rarely met a kid that claimed his parents didn't love him. Unless there were years of conflict and all kinds of terrible things that happened over the years, but that a child of 14, 15, 16, almost everyone, I don't know what they tell their parents when they're mad at them, but I'm saying normally, you know, that they definitely feel their parents love them. I think very often they feel their parents don't respect them or don't accept them. Don't accept them for who they are. Now, probably the most, these ideas that we have, these misconceptions and misperceptions, are usually not a lack of knowledge. It's usually not, you know, we didn't read that parenting book or we didn't hear that lecture or something, you know. It's not usually a lack of knowledge. The most simple explanation is because that's probably the way the parent grew up. You know, that's the natural instinct, as we are, the way we were raised. There was I find it almost always happens, if let's say if there's a parent who's like really very harsh with their child, and I really, you know, their symptoms are developing, their problems, and usually what happens is, like, if I tell the father, I says, you know, I think you're being a little bit too harsh, this is, you're undermining your relationship with your son, this is really no good. Almost always what the father will tell me is something like, I'm so harsh? You think this is harsh? You know what my father used to do to me? Almost always I get that response. If I tell a mother, you know, you're really very critical, the kid can't handle it, you're like demolishing his self-esteem. I'm critical? You know, my mother, till this very day when I don't think I ever called her that she didn't criticize me. And that's usually exactly what happens. The Messiah, there's a Messiah in this too. And the reason why it goes from generation to generation, that's one of the mysteries of life, is, you know, when you speak to kids who are even overtly abused, they all swear that they'll never do that to their children, and countless studies have shown that most often they're wrong. Right? In fact, usually the parents actually predict it. Because the parent, when the child gets older and starts complaining what the parent is doing, the parent usually answers, you just wait till you have children. You'll see you'll do the same thing. That's usually the bracha the child gets. Now, usually they're right. Partially because they said so, but there's another explanation too. And I'll tell you what the explanation is. You know, there's a... I once explained this to a kid, because the kid himself, because he knew what happened to his brothers, because all his older brothers, he's the youngest, his older brothers all beat up their kids. And like, he was like, he can't imagine, because he's starting to get nervous that he's going to do the same thing. And he says, how can I do the same thing if I always complain about it? I said, it's a simple explanation. If a guy goes to the dentist, he had a root canal. Right? He comes back and he tells his friend, he's clutching away, he's going, oh my gosh, just kill me, what my dentist did, it's terrible. So his friend will say, no, you should go see the dentist. I that we sue the dentist. That's what he had to do. This is how it feels, you know. Just because he's complaining of pain doesn't mean that he thinks there's anything wrong with what happened. It's an unfortunate reality of life. So many, since the Genshem, in order to give parents a possibility of authority over their children, the natural instinct of a child is to think that their parents are right, no matter how much they suffer, and even if they complain about it. A 21-year-old kid told me just the other week that until he came to therapy, he's been with me for about 2 months, until he came to therapy, he thought the fact that his father used to beat him up and his siblings up on a regular basis was perfectly normal. He had no idea there was anything unusual about it. Right? So it's very predictable that when he'll be, if he thought this way when he had his own children, he wouldn't do the chatchila, not that he's going to, you know, make a hini mukhin and mezumin and do it, but if the children were misbehaving and refused to do their homework, so this would be the natural instinct to do. This actually, in the last week's parsha, you know, there's, actually I think it's this week's parsha, that says, actually in both weeks' parsha, but it says about Yitzchak and Avram, there's a fascinating medrash. It says that on the pasuk b'yemi gomlos Yitzchak, so the Medrash says, the Medrash Rabbah, the first cradle of the rock was in the house of Avram Avinu. There were no Pampers before that. So according to the Matnas Kahuna, the Pshat in this Medrash means that there was a change in the physical reality of the world. Until Yitzchak, children were not born helpless infants. They were born like horses and cows. You know, they're pretty much on their own after the first day or two. And that's how children were born. And Yitzchak was the first one that was born an infant. So I saw in the Sefer Yaakov Lekech Tov, he brings down, there's another more well-known medrash that says that Avram was the first one who was old. So two things happened in Avram's house. Avram was the first one that showed the signs of aging. And Yitzchak was the first one that was an infant. What was the point of all this? Why would these changes happen? So he explains, in the Yaakov Lekech Tov, he explains that in order, the Yitzchak was the first person that was raised with a Messiah. He had to accept something from his father and give it over to his child. In order to make this possible, two things had to happen. He had to have respect for somebody who was closer to the Messiah, right? And the child had to live through years of total dependence on his parents, so that when he got older and the parents gave over to him his obligations, he'd be willing to accept it. If he was loved and cared for so many years, during the years of dependency, so then it will be easier for him to accept it. There's only two problems with this. First of all, unfortunately, this extreme dependency makes it very easy to take advantage of the child. Not willingly, of course, but even, you know, unwillingly, because the child will just do anything you tell them when they're very young, for the most part. Now, of course, don't tell any mother has, you know, two-year-old children, but you get the general drift of it. So therefore, this total dependency also makes it very difficult for a child to comprehend or to believe that something wrong is being done to them. I don't know if people remember here about, you know, in the 70s when they had all the plane hijackings, they had the thing called the Stockholm Syndrome. Everybody remember that? Okay, basically what the Stockholm Syndrome was, it was a plane that was hijacked to Stockholm and was held for quite a long time. And there was a group of hostages who were held for an extensive period of time. And one of the amazing things, before they killed a few of the hostages, and eventually they held this group for, I don't remember, it was weeks or maybe longer, I don't remember exactly. But one of the things that they were shocked to discover when they finally released these hostages, the hostages identified with the terrorists, with the hijackers. Now, when people said, you know, aren't you mad at these hijackers, what they did to you? Well, you know, you got to understand them, they're persecuted, this is the only way they can make themselves heard. And people were like shocked, you know, after all this terror you were put through, you're thinking that they're right? And that's why they coined the term the Stockholm Syndrome, that the mental health specialist then explained that when you're totally under somebody's control and they're acting in a way that frightens you, you would rather believe that there's something wrong with you than that there's something wrong with them. Right? Because if there's something wrong with you, you can always try to improve, you'll behave better. If you think there's something wrong with them, then you feel your life is at a total risk. Very few parents hijack their children, but there is a concept when a child, when there's too much harshness and too much punitive behavior, the child, in a general sense, usually they blame themselves, and therefore, there's really no reason why they shouldn't continue this tradition themselves because they see it as appropriate behavior. Okay. now, sometimes this is very tricky because, you know, chinuch only works properly when a child really feels that whatever is being done to him or her is really for their benefit. Now, of course, every parent in the world is certain, 100% certainty, whatever they're doing is for the child's benefit. But very subtly, I think, since we're all human, there are times that there are other motivations and other agendas can creep in, whether it's our honor, our sense of control, and other things. And sometimes it's very difficult to tell from the surface behavior. And the fact is, in Parshas Vayera, there's a fascinating Rav Hirsch. Rav Shamshel Hirsch says something amazing. You know, when the Pasuk describes what happened with Hagar and Yishmael, that Hagar took Yishmael, she ran out of water, and Yishmael was dying of thirst. And there's a very moving psukim there, a very moving description of what happened, that it broke Hagar's heart to see Yishmael dying of thirst, so she placed him behind the bush so she shouldn't have to see it because it was so painful. Right? It seems like a beautiful story. The way Hirsch says it, he says the following: Hagar's behavior was disgraceful and indicative of her flawed character. Rather than comfort her child in his dying moments, she thought only of herself and the discomfort she would feel in the presence of his agony. And what was really interesting, even though I'm surprised that Rav Hirsch doesn't bring it down, but if you look in the Haftarah of Parshas Vayera, it has a real contrast with the Shunamis, because she had a similar story, her son died, and says she held him in her arms the whole day until he died. And this is a real contrast to what Hagar did. So Hagar probably thought that this was a sign of her love to her child, you know, and in some ways I'm sure it was, that's why it pained her so much. But really what she was doing, she was putting her own feelings ahead of the need of the child to be comforted. And I think all of us, because we're human, there are times that we're certain that we're doing something for our children's benefit, but sometimes there are other motivations, either because the child's behavior embarrasses us, or because it somehow makes us feel we have less control. So we have to be very careful to be honest with ourselves what our true motivation is. Now, at least you think that it's only psychologists who emphasize these ideas, and, you know, because we have, you know, some of these ideas in our heads. I want to read you something what Rav Pinchas Scheinberg wrote about in the Kuntres that he put out, where he talks about the harm that a critical and a punitive parent, the atmosphere they can create in a house. And he writes the following, and I quote from a free translation: "An atmosphere of fear destroys family life, especially for the children, because they seek and need the warmth and love and acceptance of their parents. Our children need understanding, patience, and love. Fear causes psychological problems, often for the rest of the child's life. Parental reactions of sadness, anger, and disappointment have serious negative repercussions for family life. Parents cannot expect to be valued and respected by their children unless they treat them pleasantly and with tolerance. True chesed is in the home. A happy home is a healthy home. That is what children need in order to grow up calm and at peace with themselves." Okay, let me just say something about happiness. Somebody actually asked a question the other day about this question of, like, what does it mean, happiness? I'd have to be a real big philosopher to, say what happiness is. But the way I understand, at least regarding my clinical work, is the idea of being happy is being happy with yourself as a person. When we talked about being samech v'chelko, feeling that your lot in life, whether it's in your mundane manners, your financial status, or even in your spiritual situation, your spiritual status, that you're happy with yourself. And to give this over to the child, that he should also have, it's very hard for a child to be happy with himself if his parents aren't happy with themselves, because we set an example with everything. But we like the child to be happy with himself. Now, of course, as I said yesterday, and I want to make that clear again, it doesn't mean to, it says being samech v'chelkai, it doesn't say mistapik v'chelkai. It doesn't mean that you're satiated with your lot. It doesn't mean you don't try to improve yourself. It doesn't mean that you're complacent about your spiritual life. It just means that whatever you have accomplished to date, you feel happy about, you feel proud of yourself, that as much as you've accomplished, that you're happy with and you're proud, and then you continue accomplishing. I think if a child has that feeling about themselves, then that will definitely help a child to develop this type of happiness and avoid many of the problems that we've talked about. How much time do we have? I'm sorry? So, to what time should I? To what time? two more minutes? Okay. Okay, then we'll have questions. Okay. I just want to point out something that very often we do not appreciate what can happen to a child because of an unhealthy home environment later on in life, because sometimes the connections are not so clear. For instance, I very often see youngsters who have problems with anxiety or panic disorders. They have panic attacks, and it's one of the most excruciating, painful experiences for somebody to have a panic attack. These people actually feel that they're dying. And, you know, to see a 19-year-old kid suffering like this, it's like something extremely painful even to hear about it. And when you try to understand where this comes from, like what would make a child have these reactions to be so overly anxious about anything going on around them, and you can trace it back to their early life. Because one of the what these kids have in their minds, the picture of the world that they have in their mind, which was formed in the early years, is first of all, they believe the world is a dangerous place. The world, by them, is 100 times more dangerous than we. You know, when we hear reports on the radio of terrorist alerts and these type of things, of course, it makes all of us anxious. But our basic feeling is, for better or for worse, because this is how we're able to survive in the world, is, you know, basically the world, okay, that's a little bit nervous, but, you know, probably everything will be okay. Their reaction is exactly the opposite. The world is a horribly dangerous place, and anything bad that could possibly happen is likely to happen. They also believe that I am bad, and therefore I deserve that bad things should happen to me. Right? So even if they know that statistically, that, why would somebody have a phobia to go into an elevator? Right? Now, we know, unfortunately, we read once in a while in the newspaper there was some tragic accident, the elevator fell, but most often it doesn't stop us from going. These youngsters believe that if someone is upset at them, that in and itself is proof that they're wrong. It has nothing to do if it's logical why the other person is upset at them. It doesn't matter if this person is upset at everybody else in the world and nobody ever succeeded in not upsetting the person. The mere fact that the other person got upset in itself is proof that they were wrong. So you imagine you walk around in terror all day that you might upset somebody. Right? And when you have these beliefs, then it's, of course, very, very common that a person would feel tremendously anxious most of the time. Now, where would a child get the belief that either that he's a bad person, that the world is a dangerous place, that if someone's upset them, it makes them wrong? One of the most likely places to get it is how he grew up. If his parents were angry at him, and that made him automatically wrong. Now, in some houses, kids are fortunate, because even the parents are upset, they're allowed to defend themselves without being called chutzpahnik or that they're violating kibud av v'aim. They can dispute with you, they can say, listen, that didn't happen that way, or, you know, you're accusing me of that, I didn't do it, and that's an acceptable answer. So they don't, you know, to them, it's not automatic just because somebody's upset at them, even their parents, doesn't mean automatically they're wrong. Could be they are, but it's not assumed automatically. But if a parent has a great temper and the child is afraid to defend themselves, what becomes internalized is that any time somebody's upset at them, that makes them automatically wrong. Such a child will also feel he's bad, very often because they're told so, or at least that's the implication. If you're a bad person, you deserve that bad thing should happen to you. And that child, in fact, lives in a dangerous world, in his own little world, and then they project this to the rest of the world, and they're convinced that the world is a very dangerous place. And understandably, they become very anxious. So just to summarize, I once read a biography of a very successful person who overcame many hardships. He had a lot of medical problems when he was young, and he overcame many hardships in his life. And the description of his early home environment summarizes much of what we said tonight. And this I'm reading from the biography. It's a short paragraph. Growing up in an atmosphere in which affection and respect was plentiful, where the discipline was fair and loving, and the opportunities for self-expression were abundant, he came to trust that the world was basically a friendly and agreeable place. And I conclude with a tefillah, then the schus of our sincere efforts to find the proper path of chinuch, we should find success in this most challenging of our parental obligations. Thank you. Any questions, comments, disagreements?
I was talking to Dr. Srutkin said that usually takes 60 seconds before the people warm up, before they're able to percolate a question in their minds and feel the confidence to ask it.
Yeah.
So we've got another 45 seconds until, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It won't be bad if we don't ask, right?
What?
You won't be
bad. We have a question, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we have. Oh, yes.
If you can just talk a drop louder. Yeah. Right. 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 So one of the reasons I feel that it's important for a child to understand where the problem came from, not just focus on the symptom, is because usually there's a double whammy here. Because what happens is, first of all, the child feels, or the youngster feels, incompetent, inadequate, because they don't have the normal self-discipline that somebody else their age would have. And second of all, they think that they somehow created this whole problem themselves. You know why I don't have self-discipline? Because I'm a lazy bum. Right? So they have two hurdles to overcome. Imagine, how stupid, if a person, let's say, neglected, a person is driving their car and they hear terrible rattles, but they're in a big rush and they don't want to deal with it, so they pretend like they didn't hear it, and then, 5 miles in the wilderness, all of a sudden the car breaks down. You feel like a total idiot. You know, it's bad enough you have this problem, you feel like you did it to yourself. Right? So this is what these youngsters also feel. So I feel the first step of helping them get better is so that you didn't do this to yourself. Right? There were situations that happened in your life that made this very likely to happen to you. So first of all, be a little bit, be understanding of yourself. If you have that, the advantage of feeling that way is that because the road back from that is a long, hard road, and they're not going to change overnight. It's going to be little steps. You know, if they sleep every day to 12, and now they start waking up at 11, that's an incredible victory. But it's very hard to get somebody to see that. Because in their mind, they have all the criticism they've ever heard, and they know how other people look at it. So to learn to understand themselves, and understand that for you, this is an incredible victory, and you should give yourself credit for doing it, they have to understand more clearly where the problem came from. But to answer your question, it's step by step. It's every little step, and that they should appreciate how difficult it is for them.
You were talking about a test.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody did a study that struck me very interesting with the video of the child.
Jasper, yes.
To go to bed,
right.
And then gave some kind of answer. And
yeah.
Some portion of the parents, the ones that had trouble, said that this is a big problem. The ones that didn't said it wasn't really
right.
A problem at all.
Mm-hmm.
My kid still hasn't quite been born yet.
No. He's
probably been kicking his mother for
it. Right. That's so horrible.
I was actually waiting for the answer to this one.
Yeah.
Everything is
what did they do, you mean?
Of other people's children, and how much better I could see what he'd be doing, or how much worse. What I wondered was, and obviously, if the child hasn't listened,
right.
He didn't immediately jump up, click it, field, and run
right.
off to the bed.
Right. Then you'd have to worry if they did that. Yeah.
What is the answer? You don't want to crush yourself and see, we also don't want him sitting there.
Right. I want to tell you, see, that's the secret of this, because no matter how you did it, even if at some point you have to put your foot down, if you think it's normal, you do it differently. You understand? You can say, okay, that's it, and even if you pick him up and put him in his bed, you'll do it differently if you don't think that there's some horrible revolution going on. You understand? So it's not really a question. People think that that's really the issue. Now, how disciplined or how strict? Different parents have different styles, and it's not, I can tell you what I'm comfortable with, but it's totally irrelevant to anybody else. Because it's okay with other people are more comfortable. You know, some people are more comfortable, they're more strict, there's a bedtime, and they stick to it. Other parents are more laissez-faire about it, But, other than the extremes, parents who are rigid to the half a second, or parents who let the kid, stay up till 4 o'clock in the morning if it feels like it, I think there's a lot of room, for different styles that different parents are comfortable with. Again, assuming the parent sets an example, you can't demand that the child go to bed exactly at 7 o'clock and you stay up all hours of the night, drinking and smoking. So, barring those extremes, I'm saying barring those, not you, some of the world, but barring the extremes, there's a lot of room, but the question is, with what attitude do you do it? And sometimes you actually see on the parent's face, if you observe a parent, sometimes, if you ever see, if you go to a pizza shop, I don't know if they have them here, but in New York, they'll ask for them, right? And you go in and you see a mother with a child. The kid's acting like children do. Some parents, it's not how they deal with it. Some parents look at the child like he's a criminal, like he's Al Capone. Like he just did something. And other parents are a little bit more understanding. Now, sometimes they have to put a stop to it and they have to be a little bit more firm about it and, do something. It's not what they do. It's really the flavor with which they do it.
house was not built.
Yeah.
And how do we build the house?
Is that you know, first of all, by understanding that it's not the child's behavior that's so important. It's the fact that he wants to do it. They have a term for it that not objectifying the child, not looking at him as an object, seeing him as a subject. It's easier to give the example from the negative because you know this should be like a natural course of events, so it's hard to describe like saying how you breathe or something. You know, it should be the natural course. But I'll give you an example of when it's in the negative. This happened to me quite a few times. Every time I'm shocked, I don't know why I still get shocked about this stuff, but it's so shocking. Somebody will come to me. I may be a kid. I maybe saw him, let's say, twice. Right? The mother comes with him. She's in the waiting room, and the mother will tell me, "Oh, by the way, you know, I was thinking of, you know, that maybe Shimmy should go to Israel in the summer. Do you think it's a good idea?" I said, "I haven't the foggiest idea. We never discussed it." And they're like shocked. I have to discuss it with him. You know, since I've already observed him, so like, you know, now I know if it's good for him or not. Like whether he wants to go or doesn't want to go is like a totally irrelevant. That's treating a child like an object. You can ask your mechanic about your car. You just have to ask the car for its opinion. Right? When we talk about a person, my opinion whether it's a good idea for him to go or not would heavily depend if he wants to go. Right? Now, if I really thought it was a good idea and he didn't want to go, I might try to convince him why it's a good idea. And if he changes his mind after I convince him, then it might become a good idea. So it's an interactive process, but that should definitely be a big part of the question. So that's treating the child where you honor his sense of self that we're talking about a human being. Yeah. Okay, so first of all, I could say a few things about that. First of all, I don't think I said it. Did I say about the twins with the cinnamon? Did I say it to you?
To me.
Oh, I said it. Okay. I'll tell you an incredible, beautiful story that answers this question. It was published in one of the psychological journals. It really hits home this question. How do people research, you know, temperament or genetics that a child comes to the world with? The way they normally study is they take identical twins who are raised apart, who were, let's say, adopted at birth or something, raised apart, so they have like a beautiful, they have identical genes and they have different environments. So there you can really study the nature versus nurture. So this is an incredible, there was a researcher who did a lot of work with this. He was following many, many twins who were raised apart and who were identical twins. So he had these two girls who were, I remember, like 6 years old at the time of this particular incident, that he'd been found. They were both of these twins, identical twins, were identical twin girls, were adopted at birth by different parents. So he goes to visit the two sets of parents, wants to follow up on this case. So he goes to the first parent and says, "So how's Mary doing?" And the mother says, Mary, she's doing pretty well. Meal times is very difficult." "What's the problem?" He says, "Meals are battles. Battles, we fight every meal, it's terrible." "What's the problem?" "She has this mishigas. She needs to put cinnamon on everything she eats. She drives me crazy. She has to, you have to put cinnamon in her cereal, on her potatoes, on her this, on her noodles, everything with cinnamon. I'm telling you, every meal is a battle." So they go then to the mother of the other child who lives 100 miles away, and they say, "So how is Sarah doing?" "Say, everything's fine, no problem, wonderful, everything. You sure everything is fine? Everything is wonderful, no complaints. You sure everything, everything. How are meal times?" "Meal times are the easiest. You just put cinnamon on her food and she'll eat anything you give her." This is a true story. This is a true story. Again, it's a matter of perspective. They obviously, there's actually been many studies of identical twins that are 50 years old that grew up apart and found each other. 50, they're shocked. They wear the same brand sneakers. They smoke the same brand cigarettes. They drink the same brand beer. So that seems to be a genetic predisposition. The question is what you do with it. Is it, you know, now, the genetics has been overplayed in the popular press to a dramatic degree. In fact, I have something here. I skipped it because of time, but let me read it to you if you ask the question. You know, because today they find genes for everything. You know, there's the gambler gene, the alcoholism gene, we even had the God gene. Yeah, they got everything. They covered all their bases. So this is what one of the most prominent genetic researchers in the world said the following in a special issue of Science on this subject. "The interactions of genes and environment is much more complicated than the simple violence genes and intelligence genes touted in the popular press. the same data that show the effects of genes also point to the enormous influence of non-genetic factors. So let's say in mental health, you know, it's almost universally believed that the serious mental illness, let's say, schizophrenia or serious depression, you know, people everywhere believe that it's practically totally genetic. And they're supposedly mentioning these as twin studies. The highest numbers anybody ever found, even the people who push these ideas, the highest numbers anybody ever found for concordant rates of identical twins, let's say with schizophrenia, the highest numbers was 30-something percent. That means the rest is all environmental. And that is exactly what this researcher is saying. So, of course, temperament. So let's say the problem with temperament. There have been many studies that show that children are born with different temperaments. Right? Some children are a little bit more outgoing, some more introverted, some respond to stimuli quicker than others. But it's what you do with it again. You know, so if a child is a little bit shy, you can handle it in different ways. You can embarrass him about the fact that he's shy. Says, don't be a little baby. That usually does wonders. Right? Or you could try to encourage him in other ways or make him more comfortable. So, you know, it is something that a parent has to take in consideration. Often the way parents use it is like, oh, that's my shy one. Well, that's my dumb one, you know, and you know, that just further exacerbates the problem rather than try to influence in a different direction. So with temper, and I once thought that maybe, you know, Chazal talk about tzar gidul banim, right? That the pain of raising children. Now, since Chazal said universally, I assume it doesn't mean when somebody has a problem with a child. It probably means in a normal raising of a child, there has to be some pain. So I was always wondering what the pain is. I thought it's because I'll mean waking up in the middle of the night when the baby has an earache. I don't think they would have made a special statement about that. I really think that tsar is a need to adapt your personality, your temperament to the child's temperament. That is indeed very painful. You know, it never happened, you know, if your kid has problems in school with a teacher, right? And you go speak to the principal, and the principal says, it's a personality conflict. You know, your six-year-old child and the teacher are having a personality conflict. You know, and I'm always wondering, who asked who asked the teacher to have a personality? She's being paid to be a teacher. Adapt your personality. You know? It's not like you don't want to be friends with that person because you have a personality conflict. So don't be friends with them. If you're a teacher, take care of the student. Yeah, personality conflict. I never understood that, where that came from. Now, certainly a parent can't have a personality, you cannot afford the luxury of having a personality conflict with their child. So what happens? Let's say the parent is a neat freak. Right? Now, some of the children can, you know, get into that. Not that it's ever good for them, but they can get into that. But there's some child that just can't deal with it because he is never going to be a neat freak no matter how hard he tries. Now, it's very difficult for the parent, you know, to put up with this. You know, you walk into his room, it looks like a tornado hit it, you know, and you have to be okay with it. So that's very painful. I think that's my understanding of tsar gidul banim.
Like sometimes when you ask the kids to go clean their room, mm-hmm. We all have this system, we go clean their room, no problem, and it's fine. Now, like you want to take that child to spend 30 months, can you say to them to go and hold the room up for their job? Like how do you do that without, like, you know, there's that kid who really don't like to clean, whatever.
Very good question,
You want to praise that child. You praise your child who does this with you in front of the other kids?
Well, let me just say, it's an excellent question. I think there's really two points here. First of all, in the praise, very often the message a child gets is you're praising them for listening to you. Really, you should praise the child for cleaning up his room. You understand that it's really for his benefit, for her benefit, to have a neat room. And even children who don't like to clean the room don't mind having a clean room. They just don't want to be the one to do it. Right? So, you know, giving over the value of cleanliness and neatness should be the main part of the message, not so much for listening to you. Now, as far as doing it in front of another child, the reason why maybe not to do it is because most often, at least subconsciously, the agenda of the parent is to criticize the other child. But they heard a lecture somewhere, you shouldn't criticize children or something, you know, so they try to avoid it. So the way they do it indirectly, you know? They, you know, by praising the one who's doing it, it's like by implication, all right, listen, you know, he's a good one, but look at you. So you have to be very careful to, you know, be aware of your own motivation in doing such things. Yes?
How do you teach a child the idea of self at the same time?
Now, I'm not saying that's a chesaron. It shouldn't necessarily be the main. I'll tell you, it's very simple. The way a child learns is, like I just quoted before, from, I think from Rav Pinchas Scheinberg, and I saw from Hashem Shul Fall Hirsch, says that if anybody expects their child to respect them, if they don't respect their child, then they're in for a big surprise. So it's another way of excited, the same way you expect your child to put on tefillin, if you put on tefillin. You set an example. So now, there are different rules. Now, the respect that a parent is obligated to give to his child has a whole different flavor than the respect that a child has to the parent. Just like the respect you would have to your shoemaker, there is, you go to your shoemaker, you have to treat him with respect, cover the adam, and you know, proper derecheret, right? But if you go see the gadol hador, there's a different form. It takes a different form and has a different surah and a different shape. They're both issues of respect and they're both serious obligations. It just takes a different right? You tell him, you teach him, you say to him, you know, there's halacha kibud avim, you're not supposed to sit in Tati's chair. But if it'll be clear to the child if it's a power play on your part or if it's because it's your obligation to teach it, then just, the question is like this, I think in many homes, or not many, but certainly in some, there's such a thing that like this, when a child talks disrespectfully to the parent, there is a swift, very clear, very strong reaction. When the child disrespects their sibling, called mama, there's absolutely no reaction. Now, what is the message of that? That we're worried about Avodas Hashem? Is that the message a child gets? Or we're worried about our own kavod? If what we're worried about is the Ratzon Hashem, so the Baruch Shem is just as unhappy when a child disrespects their peer, their sibling or a friend, and insults them or embarrasses them in public, that they are when they embarrass them. I've had parents describe to me the most horrendous scapegoating of one of their children. All the kids gang up on the child, and this is going on for a long time. The kid develops a serious emotional disorder. They come and the parents describe, this thing has been going on for 5 years. I say, have the kids been living in Alaska? Like, where were you? And I ask the parents, if the kid disrespected you, did you have the same reaction? No, that was a whole different reaction. So that's the message. You know, if the idea of kavod in general, kavod abrius, and kavod adam is something that's important across the board, there are specific chiyuvim that relate to a child, to a parent. And I don't think there's anything wrong with, not only wrong, it's an obligation, like any other mitzvah, to teach a child. What's the halacha? There's only one caveat. You see, in other mitzvahs, there's no escape clause. If your child doesn't want to put on tefillin, you have a problem because there's really no way to get around it. In kibud avim, there's an immense escape clause. You could be meichel him. You see, there was a story with a stipler about this, that there was a fellow that came to the stipler and he said he's very worried about his kids ayom haba. They're very caring parents. Listen, you worry, you know, you don't have to worry about your kids ayom haba, you have to worry about his ayom haba too. What's the problem, asked him the stipler? My child doesn't listen to me. I tell him what to do, he doesn't listen. What's going to be with his ayom haba? The stipler told him, I'm much more worried about your ayom haba than your child. Because your child's ayom haba, there's a simple solution. Be mindful of him, and that's it. You solved the problem. But you, that you're being naive, and you're telling him things you know he's not going to listen, who's going to be mindful of you? So, you know, it's your ayom haba that I got to worry about. So, yeah, so as long as it's done in the proper spirit, I think, and it's seen like any other mitzvah, just for some reason, parents get much more enthusiastic about that mitzvah than other mitzvahs. In fact, every school that has, you know, the schools that have the Midas campaigns, yeah, and we'll talk about that tomorrow morning, but just one point on it, you know, the schools that have the Midas campaign, for some odd reason, the first Midah that's always taught is Kibud Avim. Did you notice that? I guess it's to get the parents enthusiastic about the campaign. Okay. Anybody else? Yes.
You met with the boys and the girls.
Yeah. Now, first of all, let me say that although I'm not sure exactly of the status of confidentiality in this type, I'm not sure of the legal, no, I'm serious, I, you know, I take confidentiality very, very serious. I did not really get their permission. I usually, whenever I see a kid, I never will speak to a parent or a teacher or anyone else unless I get their permission. I'm not sure of the legal status of this meeting that I had with them, but nonetheless, I'm really not that comfortable answering that question. I hope you will understand. Okay? But of course, most of the things that I spoke about addresses both general things that I've experienced and some of the, you know, the things that I've...
Yeah. I
don't think it's that much different than other communities. I think it's more our contemporary culture. I don't mean the secular culture, but our culture, that parents have way too much expectations from their children. And I think that they generally walk around, no matter how well they're doing, they walk around feeling that we're disappointed in them. Right? And they internalize it. You know, you speak to any teacher in Beis Yaakov will tell you, at least in New York, that if you give a girl a 98 on a test, she's almost certain to start crying. Yeah, that's true. I ask any of the Beis Yaakov teachers. It's like a tragedy. If you give them anything below, actually it's worse now because they can get extra credit. So if they get below the extra credit, it's like a chorben. You know? So that's, I think, the general idea. Yes?
So I'm listening to what you're saying, and I'm having these two reactions because I'm thinking about my younger kids, all the wonderful things I can do with them now and everything. You know, I always hear the most terrible mistakes I made, and, you know, as a chorben. So my question there is more, with the older children, you know, all the mistakes they made and everything, and the quote unquote damage that's been done, if a parent makes a dramatic change, how dramatically can they impact
the older children?
The teenagers, the God issues they're dealing with.
So I'll tell you the answer. I once heard in a speech, somebody said over from the Shem Mishmul, the Sachet Shavar, I looked for it inside, I couldn't find it, but he's a reliable person, so I guess maybe said it somewhere where I didn't find it. But he said the reason why the oldest child gets a double portion in the Yerusha is to compensate him for being practiced on. So I guess we're all in that same boat. All the older children always complain that the younger ones get away with stuff that they never got away with. Unfortunately, we all have to learn from our own experience. I know why we can't learn from other people's experience, but I guess that's human nature. Things that we used to think are so important, you have to put your foot down and you have to respond to, you know, as we get older, we discover it really wasn't necessary and it was harmful. But to answer your question, what to do? So I'll tell you, actually, God did us a tremendous favor, among the many others, that children have an incredible desire to have a decent relationship with their parents, even when they're rebellious teenagers. Sometimes there's a lot of damage done and it's very difficult to overcome that hump because they're afraid of being re-traumatized. But most often it hasn't reached yet that level. If there's still some communication, it's pretty easy. I hate to compare it to a dog, but I think they say if you kick a dog or something, they come back. I'm not sure. I don't know that much about dogs, but what I read is some similarities. And, you know, because children want, I mean, it's the most painful, I've dealt with kids who have no contact with their parents, and it's so painful to them, even though at some point they try to believe that they don't care. I don't care, but every 3 weeks they bring it up again, you know, they don't care, why are they always talking about it? So there is always that opening, and usually if things haven't gotten very bad, which in most cases not, you know, if you show that really the dramatic change, the way to operate, you know, to conceptualize or what you can do operationally, not just theoretically, but this is what I tell parents when they have serious problems with their teenagers, like what to do. The first thing is to do is stop criticizing. That usually does wonders. But even more than that, conceptually, if you show your child that you, at this point you're more concerned about his happiness than about his behavior, that usually has a very dramatic change. I don't mean dramatic in the sense like overnight, it could take months, but that is a very, because usually what happens when a kid misbehaves, we become obsessed with his behavior, understandably so, because he's misbehaving. So by showing that difference, that you become much more interested in his happiness, or, you know, would this work out for you? Would you be happy doing this? It's the same thing somebody asked me recently about some child who dropped out of school or something. So what job do you think he should have? I have no idea. I never discussed jobs. How do I know what job he should have? Well, do you think, and they didn't hear me. He says, well, so do you think I was thinking I have a cousin who has this business? I have no idea. You know, you could bring up any suggestion to him. Talk to him. And so even though he won't know, I guarantee you any question you ask, he'll say, I don't know. I have no idea because he doesn't have a self. But just by asking the question that way, that develops the self, that you're interested in wanting to know what he wants. So I think, does that answer your question? Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, you haven't heard it. It wasn't a mistake. Yeah, no, it's a good question. Yeah. Okay, sure. Yeah, excellent question, and I'm glad you brought it up because I should have related to it. You know, this is not what you said, but there's something that people say that is very similar, and I think there's a similar answer to it. There are sometimes when people are quite harsh with their children, and I ask them, you know, why are you doing it this way, and they say, well, look, the world is a tough place. You know, if you're too nice to your kid, he'll come out there in the world, he won't know what to do. You know, in order to harden the child, you got to be tough with him. As I said, that's not what you said at all. I know. No, I'm just connecting it. I specify that you didn't say that. No. I won't connect it, you know, but I want to bring out a point. So I tell them that it is true that the world is a harsh place and difficult things and bad things can happen, but it should never be that the parent is the source of those difficulties. So what happens is like this. Since it's inevitable that things will happen in life, there'll be consequences, there'll be difficulties. If the parent is always there with the child, how can I help you with this? How can I teach you the skills to deal with this situation? Then the child looks at the parent as the person that helps them deal with the difficulties in life and helps them develop the tools to deal with the difficulties in life. When the parent is the source of the hardship, it has a whole different connotation. So now the same thing with consequences. You know, we need to remember, this is a point, well, actually we've spoken about it, I spoke with the rabbi about it. There's, you know, years ago, there was no Yiddishkeit in America, you know, two generations ago. If the parents weren't the ones who were pushing it, the kid would never hear about it. He wouldn't know, he went to public school, he never heard of Shabbos, he doesn't know what it is. You know, most kids today are going to school. They hear about it from 7 o'clock in the morning till 8 o'clock at night. We don't have to push it, we have a different task now. We have to be there to cushion it. You know, like when Matthew Solomon said, I said it yesterday, I think, that, you know, a kid comes home from school, his mother should not be harassing him about homework, she should be giving him cookies and milk. He's been harassed all day. Right, so same thing with consequences. You're right, of course there are consequences in the world. And the child will learn it pretty quickly. When he's 3 years old in playgroup, he'll learn about consequences. He grabs the kid's toy, the kid will bop him over the head. Right? So we don't have to inject it so strongly. I'm not saying we shouldn't deal with it at all, you know, but I think we tend to overdo it because we can help the child. If a child comes home crying that, you know, that Shlomi, you know, hit him over the head and you ask him what happened, you found out he grabbed away a toy, he said, that's how it works, you know, that if you want to play with somebody and if you don't, and you don't want to share with them, nobody's going to play with you. Yeah. Yeah. How old is the child?
14, 15.
Okay, no, I want to know if he was 6, you know, and I just want to know what age we're talking about. A teenager, okay. Now, the question is, what has happened, all, you know, what was this like a dramatic change? You know, was it like this all along? Was this like something new?
No,
I think it really depends, because you have to know the meaning of the behavior. See, just telling the child, you don't, if you don't go to shul on time, you know, you don't get to eat with us, let's say. Right? Whatever consequences, you know, you won't be able to go rollerblading on Sunday. I don't know, whatever it is that you tell him. It's, to me at least, it's incomprehensible how that could possibly be helpful. You know, it's certainly not going to teach you. It's doing nothing is a very respectful thing if you can't think of anything to do. And I'm serious. You know, some parents, if that's the best idea you can come up with, it's better than doing something that's clearly not good. You understand? Parents often tell me, you know, they come up with some idea that will clearly be destructive, and when I point out that that will probably make things twice as bad, they very often tell me, oh, so you mean I should do nothing? I say it's really better than doing something. You know, if you come up with a different idea that might be constructive, we'll think about it. But better than doing nothing is a very respectable idea when doing something will make things worse. And therefore, I mean, as a general solution, yeah, you want to say something about this?
Yes.
Yeah, okay, yes.
From a selfish perspective, I mean, you might not like most of the stuff,
right,
but it shows in back of my head, saying I can't care, you know, what I'm doing.
If you do what? If you do.
If you go to school. If you have a parent who doesn't say anything about going to school late, then in back of my head, saying, well, let's not really be that poor.
Really? Even if their parents get up early in the morning to go to shul, even though the father gets up at 5 o'clock in the morning to go to daf yomi, and he thinks it's not important to them?
Because it may be important for the father, but he's worried about me, you know, maybe I'm too tired to be understanding.
And would that be so terrible? If a child would see that his father going to shul in the morning is one of the most important things in the world, and he himself, even when he stays up late, he gets up at 5 o'clock, he goes to learn, and then he goes to daven on a daily basis, right, but that he understands for the child, especially teenagers, a lot of them have a hard time getting up in the morning, and he's sympathetic that, you know, maybe it's hard for him to get up. I would say that it's actually probably not so terrible, and what the child will internalize is, you know, the goal in life is to be a responsible person, to get up in the morning, and one day I'm going to be like Tati. Right now I'm still young, I'm not so, you know, it's a little hard for me, but when I get older, I hope to be like Tati, and I'm going to do that too. I don't think that's so terrible. And as far as I can tell from life experience, that usually works a lot better than the other way. Yes.
What is the external pressure on the parents? For example, homework. If you have a child who goes to school from 8 o'clock in the morning to 5:30 at night, and they're 9 years old, their brains don't work anymore, and then they have 3 hours worth of homework. Now, you can tell them, you can be very chill about the homework, but you know that the kid then is going to turn around and have to go to school and not have their homework or fall apart. And the parents are in the position of knowing what the heck to do. If you go to the school doesn't work with you because you think the parents.
Now, of course.
You know that parents are not respected by anybody in the school.
They actually claim the opposite. If you complain about it, they say, well, other parents complain. I don't know who these other parents are. I've never discovered that. The parents complain that they're not enough homework. Yeah. I would love to meet those parents. Yeah. Right. So first of all, very often half the kids aren't doing their homework. Sometimes the parents are overly concerned about authority figures. And on the outside chance that the principal will complain to them, they're terrified of it. Right, and sometimes half the class isn't doing their homework and they're all getting away with it. You know, so it's very often not as bad as we think. Sometimes if a kid wouldn't do it, nothing horrible will happen. And I would say if he's willing to face the music, you know, and let him be the judge, you know, if he'll come back and say, look, this is an impossible situation because the teacher says whoever doesn't do the homework will throw him out of school, so then you have to take a different approach. And sometimes only eight is to do the homework for them. I don't just out of rachmanis, like you do a chesed for a poor man you find in the street. Sometimes that, you know, if you see a guy starving in the street, you got to give him a few dollars to buy food. Yeah. Yes, I see I didn't answer your question fully, but I answered as best as I can. Okay. Yeah, once I saw me, I thought you have to speak. Again, it could be usually the kids who are more likely to be rejected are often kids who already experience rejection. Now, when kids feel rejection at home, let's say, then because usually the kids who are picked on are usually the vulnerable kids. Now, although sometimes the vulnerability is external, the child is very short or perhaps heavy, but sometimes another child who looks exactly like them who's not being picked on. So very often it should raise in the parent's mind a thought, you know, is there something that's going on at home that's making him more vulnerable? Actually, one of the rabbis here said over a wonderful story, I think, very insightful. You know, there was a child in the class that the Rebbe told him, made a minor comment, like, you know, his hand was on top of the sefer, and he asked him if he can please move it away, and the kid started crying. So he called him into the office and said, there's something going on at home. And the kid burst out crying and, you know, said that something is going on in his house, because it would be very insightful. I just want to say a name because I don't like to get permission to say the story. But to have the insight that why is the child so sensitive? Like, why is he having this reaction? There must be something disturbing him. So therefore, You understand? I don't think always. Some kids may be temperamentally more sensitive than others, and they need extra help by us showing that we're sympathetic and we listen. And if you have any practical advice, sometimes there are things that you could give practical advice, but just you caring. But the first thing is, parents, we don't have control over their environment to a great degree. If there's something really going on that's terrible, sometimes kids are really picked on, and sometimes by the teacher, not necessarily by students. And the parents, like, because they're intimidated by authority, do nothing. I once treated a 16-year-old kid who was, like, smoked pot all day, and the mother told me herself that she remembers that in second grade there was a Rebbe that it was known. He's been a Rebbe for 35 years. Every year he picks one carbon, he picks on that kid. It's like a tradition. Everybody in the school knows it, and when you complain to the, whoever complains to the prince, you know, to the school, they tell him that you're the first parent who ever complained about it. So, anyways, and the mother never did anything. And I don't think that's the showing bias problems on, there were other things that contributed, but that was definitely a very big factor. And the kid once told me very proudly, you know, I guess the mother understood to do this, he says, you know what my mother did for my sister? Some teachers started up with, my mother went to the class and she turned over the principal's desk and said she's calling the board of ed if he doesn't take care of it. And he was like all pumped about it, that, you know, his mother stuck up for his sister. So, you know, if you have to know the situation, is it really the child's vulnerability? If it is, where it's coming from? If it's really something terrible going on in the school, there's a bunch of kids who are gangsters, you know, picking on little kids, then you have to intervene at that level.
I want to thank Dr. Borowski for the beautiful presentation, insightful observation. Mr. Sunday morning at 10 a.m. Continue. Need those words or experience. Yes, there is a Lava Malka probably, a collation as they call it, Lava Malka. Please, you hear, avail yourself of it without keeping it.